This episode of the Lunch with Chris show is brought to you by my upcoming book, 30 Days to Limitless. You can find out more about it at limitless30.com.
This podcast is certified fresh.
Freshmediaworks.com.
Welcome to the Lunch with Chris show, where your host, Chris Daly, talks with movers and shakers from all walks of life to get their opinions on important questions. Each season, there is a new question and new guests. This short, impactful show skips all the fluff and just brings you insightful answers from great guests. And now, doing his part to change the world in a positive way, your host, Chris Daly.
Hey, everybody, welcome out to another Lunch with Chris. This season, as you know, I am focusing on everyday heroes. Yes, those people who seem like normal Americans, but are really superheroes, who are doing things that we know are tough, that we love to watch, we love to cheer on, but maybe things that maybe we might not have the guts to do ourselves. So today my guest is Charlotte Laws, and this is a fascinating story. All right, everybody, join me in welcoming Dr. Charlotte Laws to the show. Dr. Laws, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you bet. You bet. I tell you, I watch a lot of documentaries. It drives my wife crazy. But I watched the documentary, The Most Hated Man on the Internet, and fell in love with you because of all the things you do I don't know, there's so many areas I want to go over with you. The deal with this revenge porn site that you played a huge role in bringing down. I also want to go over the party crashing thing you've done, because I love that. The Tribs Over Trolls, the animal advocacy, you name it. I mean, the more I find out about you, the more I think she is so cool.
Well, thank you.
You bet. So let's start with the Netflix documentary or the situation first. I think it was incredibly brave for your daughter to come to you and say, hey, this is something that happened. If you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, she had been hacked. And a few days after she was hacked, her topless picture was loaded onto the most notorious revenge porn website. And she had taken over 100 pictures in her room. One of them was topless. She never had any intention of ever sending the topless picture to anybody. But when her cell phone got full, she had forwarded the pictures over to her email to store them. And it was her email that got hacked. So she was at work at a waitress job when she was told that she was on this site, and she was distraught. She felt violated, humiliated. She was completely freaked out. And she phoned me from the parking lot and told me. And I had never heard of revenge porn before this. And I immediately went on the site and I saw the pictures of her, the topless, plus there were some closed pictures of her as well. Mm-hmm. It identified her name, her social media link, and the city where she lived. So she did have identifying information there. And I just knew that it had to come down right away because I knew how the internet worked. And if you put a topless picture online, it's going to be on one site today, 5 sites tomorrow, 50 sites in a week, and 1,000 sites in 6 months. So I knew that it would just populate and, you know, end up haunting her for the rest of her life. So I just kind of hunkered down to try to get that picture removed. My daughter came home from work. She locked herself in her room. She didn't want me to tell anybody about this. She didn't want anyone to know, even though many of her friends were finding out. The people at her workplace found out. The assistant manager told her, I could get you fired over this. And she was getting calls from strange men, even somebody in the porn industry, a well-known guy in the porn industry called her and wanted to talk business. So she was really disgusted by all of these things that were happening, and she shut down her social media and just, you know, didn't want any contact with the world. So that's how it started. Mm-hmm. And I just started working I kind of have a private eye personality, but I also used to be a private investigator back in the 1980s. So I just kind of started investigating the website and the owner and looking at all the different avenues to potentially get that photo removed. And that's how it started.
Nice. And I assume you started the logical way, making a phone call, sending an email, requesting it, correct? But that didn't
work. we sent Hunter Moore a couple of emails and requested him to remove the picture. We told him it had been hacked and he still wouldn't remove it. And my daughter also owned the copyright, so we told him that he was violating copyright law. Nice. And he didn't care about that either, because copyright tends to be a civil case. And even though you can go to court and get potentially $250,000 per photo from the person who is using your images, Hunter Moore didn't care about civil suits. He only cared about criminal. He didn't want to go to jail. He was very afraid of law enforcement. He was not afraid of being sued because he had no assets.
Got it. And then a lot of people would have stopped right there. It would have been, oh, well, I tried. There's not much I can do. I don't necessarily want to take this to court. You know, luckily you had a card in your pocket in that you're married to a lawyer. But even that didn't work initially, right?
Yeah, he didn't. He doesn't really go on the internet.
Right.
And so he just thought, oh, it'll go away if you ignore it. We did eventually tell him because I wanted to get a legal letter. Mm-hmm. And because at first, Kayla didn't even want him to know either. And that's her stepfather. And she didn't want him to know. And but when we did tell him, he just laughed and said, this is no big deal. And Kayla got very upset and cried and ran to her room. And so the whole household was in complete turmoil. And finally, he did agree to let me write a legal letter. He would read it and sign it. And we did send that off, but it didn't have any, you know, it didn't help in any way. So I just started looking at different avenues. I started contacting everybody I could think of associated with Hunter Moore. I called his publicist, I had several conversations with his attorney. I called some of his advertisers, and I even tried to call his mom. And I called a workplace where she had previously worked. She didn't work there anymore, but I spoke to some of her former colleagues. And so I was just trying to put pressure on him from various directions. And I know people were going to him and saying, Hunter, remove this picture. This is causing way too much trouble. Yeah. And I think that just made him get his back up more and say, there's no way I'm ever removing this picture. Mm-hmm. And at one point, I even got the head of Black Lotus Communications, his name is Jeffrey Lyon, to help us. And he blocked her page. He was the head of, he did security for Hunter's website. And so he said, okay, I might be able to block the page. So they blocked the page. And the next day Hunter went around and made up a whole new page for Kayla. I mean, he was so determined to keep her picture up there. So, you know, it was really crazy. And we went to the Los Angeles Police Department, and there was a female middle-aged detective who said to Kayla, why would you take a picture like this if you didn't want it on the internet? So she was doing the victim blaming, and really everybody was. I mean, regular people, the media, law enforcement, the politicians, everybody was saying it's the victim's fault. And that was Hunter Moore's line as well. So then I called the FBI. And the FBI initially just wanted me to file a report online, which I knew meant they weren't going to do anything. They were just too busy with other cases and they wouldn't do anything. So I said to them, oh, I see. You help Scarlett Johansson when she gets hacked, but you don't help the average person. And the operator sighed and said, let me transfer you to a detective. Nice. And they told me that three agents would be coming to the house later in the month, which was like 3 weeks later. Yeah. So in the meantime, I started, Kayla found out one of her friends was on the site as well. Mm-hmm. And she talked to this friend and the friend said she was hacked. So now here I am with this website. I only know two people on it. They're both hacked. So I'm saying to myself, it seems like there must be a hacking scheme. Right. So I set up my own little study and I contacted 40 people who were posted in this 2 week period around when my daughter was posted. And it was very hard contacting them because I couldn't use like social media or email because I was afraid the hacker might be on their devices. So I had to do everything very roundabout. I had to phone, and a lot of times I'd get their last name and the city where they lived, and I'd have to call someone with the same last name and say, hi, are you related to so-and-so? Could you have this person call me? It was a lot of work. But I found out that 40% of those people had been hacked, and that we knew some of them at least had been hacked by the same hacker. So that's kind of, you know, the beginning of how the story begins anyway.
And then it became a hacking issue, and that kind of, you know, there were strong laws against that. There weren't real strong laws against revenge porn. Nobody really knew what it was.
Yeah, there were no laws against revenge porn. Right. So getting him on posting, you know, photos, we weren't going to be able to do that unless it was the hacking scheme. And so luckily, when the FBI came, they originally said they probably wouldn't be able to take the case. But I had about a 12-inch file at that point of information about Hunter, about his website, along with a bunch of hacked victims. And I was able to just hand it over to them and say, here you go. And here are a bunch of people who were hacked, and many of them by the same hacker as my daughter. And I hopefully that helped, because they were able to get approval to move forward on the case. But they did tell me also initially that it would take over a year to investigate, because their investigations are very long and drawn out. And by that time, I was also counseling victims, and I was talking to so many people, and I had gone public with my name. I tried to hide it for as long as I could. But once I went public and Hunter knew I was his adversary, his family, he had this cult following, and they started coming after me with death threats and computer viruses. And I even had a stalker come to the house. So it was really mayhem. It was crazy and very scary.
Yeah. Yeah. And then long story short, you win the battle.
Finally, he was arrested.
Right, exactly. Which is so awesome. And you become known as a certified badass.
I like that.
Exactly. I mean, it just blew me away. And of course, the FBI, once they started looking through your boxes of documents, they had to go, whoa, need to give this lady a job. So tell me, the documentary very early on touches on your party crashing background. And I love that, because I'm in the sports industry is my main gig, and have done that with so many sporting events and things. And I used to always tell people, just act like you're supposed to be here. So tell me about that. I love that.
Yeah. I mean, I actually used to do it with the Miami Dolphins for sporting, because I liked the Dolphins a lot. I grew up in Georgia, but I went to school in Florida, and I used to go down to the Dolphin games, and I would always crash, and I'd always get in, and I'd sit on the field, you know, I'd watch from the field, and then I'd go over to the locker room afterwards and hang out outside the locker room. So that was my sports related crashing. But yeah, I started doing it when I was a kid. And when I was 16, 17, 18, it was kind of more for fun. And my friends would be going out bowling or going out to the bar. And I'd say, no, I'd rather hang out with the president or Lee Iacocca or Michael Jackson. You know, to me, that was more interesting. Yeah. As I got older, I learned that crashing could be used for better purposes, such as pushing for legislation. Some of these events are $50,000, $100,000 per person, and you want to get FaceTime with the president or a senator, it's really only access for the rich people in society. Ordinary people don't get that access. However, if you crash, you get the access. You know, you get their ear, you get in their face, and you can actually talk to them about what you want to talk to them about. I also learned I could use it for getting celebrities or well-known people or wealthy people signed on to causes. You know, these are people that have money and they can help with charity events. And I learned I could get celebrity interviews. When I was writing that first book, Meet the Stars, I wanted to do a lot of celebrity interviews for the book, but it's a real hassle if you call the person's publicist and then they have to set it up. And oh, it'll be 2 weeks after Tuesday at 3 o'clock. You get two, you know, it's like a nightmare. But hey, if you just go to the Golden Globes or the Emmys or the Academy Awards, you can literally go from person to person and you can get 30 interviews in one night. And they always say yes, because it's good PR for them. They want to be interviewed. They want to be in the newspapers or magazines. So those were some of the things I would, as I got older, that I realized, oh yeah, this party crashing can really have some great benefits, and great benefits for society as well, you know? Yeah. So I've kind of done it all my life since I was like 16, 17, but I don't do it very often anymore.
Yeah. If you could drop some names. So, cause I've seen some lists and it's just fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, I've been to so many of, I mean, I've been to all the award shows multiple times, and I mean, the most recent events, cause I haven't been doing it that much in recent years. And during COVID, I didn't do it at all. Right. And it would be hard actually, I think, to do it during COVID probably, but yeah, I mean, I did it, back in, I guess, 2012, I went to a fundraiser for Obama at George Clooney's house in Studio City. And the Secret Service regarding like the streets around the estate. And so I pretended to be making a pharmaceutical delivery. And I had this little bag on my seat. It was a last minute thing. And thank God they didn't look in the bag, because there was nothing pharmaceutical. It was ponytail holders that were in there. But I said, I have a delivery for G. Clooney. And I think they thought, oh God, this could be an emergency. We better let her up to the house. So I got up that way. And I went to the 2018 Golden Globes. And the only reason I went to this particular event, because I had a book out called Devil in the Basement, which was about a true story about my grandfather, who was killed by a devil worshiper in 1948. And he was also the victim of prejudice because he was Italian. And so he was kicked out of two law offices and also out of his house for being Italian, because the CCNR said no Italians, no Blacks. You know, there was a long list of groups who were disallowed from living in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to get this to Oprah, but her website said, you know, she has a book club. So that's why I wanted her to read it. And her website said, do not send your book. It goes straight in the trash. So I thought, okay, I have to hand it to her. Where am I going to do that? And I knew she'd be at the Golden Globes. And again, it was really hard to get in there. It's actually the hardest award show I've ever gotten into, because they had the streets blocked off like a few blocks away from the Beverly Hilton where it was being held. Mm-hmm. And so, but luckily I was able to get past the barricades. I went through the back of the hotel. They had a construction zone back there. So here I am in my high heels and my long dress, holding up my bottom of my dress, and I'm stepping around mud and piles of dirt and tractors. And I mean, it was crazy. And I get up to close to the back door, and a guard comes over and says, can I help you? And I said, oh yeah, I was already in. I just went up to Starbucks to get some coffee. Cause I remembered seeing a Starbucks when I was walking down there, and he somehow bought it. And I ended up getting in, and I gave the book to Oprah, and I ended up sitting in the front. I sat next to Ridley Scott, and I sat two people away from Natalie Portman, and Reese Witherspoon was like right at the next table, and Oprah was like two tables away from me. So, you know, I did accomplish that goal, but it never made it into the book club, and I have no idea if she even looked at it.
That's fascinating. I love it. And as much as I would love to go to a party at George Clooney's house, I don't think I would have the balls to do what you did. You just continue to amaze me. Wow. So, if you could, let's shift gears and talk about Tribs Over Trolls, because this is fascinating to me. That's kind of what this series is about. I mentioned to you, it's about pointing out everyday heroes and telling good stories that normal people are doing. So tell me about Tribs Over Trolls.
Well, I started it because you know, basically to kind of support victims online who are being bullied, you know, who are being, you know, harassed with words on the internet. And so tribs are like tributes, mm-hmm. or compliments. And trolls, of course, we all know what trolls are online. And so the idea is that when somebody's being victimized, that people come to that person's aid, that, you know, and you can even post it. I mean, I even have a page on Twitter. It's Tribute USA is the Tribs Over Trolls page, but you can post, oh, blah, blah, blah is being harassed at this link, and people can go there and support the victim and say, oh, you're beautiful, you're wonderful, we're on your side, whatever. Because, you know, some of this bullying can lead to suicide. I mean, it can lead to really drastic and, you know, horrible situations. And so I think the regular public need to start coming to the aid of people who are being victimized online. And I think it's a much better approach to get the public involved than to have these tech companies playing God, censoring everything that they think they should be censoring, because I feel like it's very biased. I feel like it's very political. I feel like it, you know, they're just making these arbitrary decisions about, you know, what information should stay and what should go, or who should be on and who should be kicked off the platform. And, you know, a lot of times they'll label something misinformation that's not misinformation, right, later is proved to be true.
Yeah.
So I don't support what the tech companies are doing at all. I think revenge porn is a very different thing. Mm-hmm. I think private images of individuals should be exempt from First Amendment, just like child pornography or incitement or libel, or, you know, some of the other things that we have on the list. And, you know, the free speech is supposed to be a public issue about the marketplace of ideas. Nude pictures of ordinary people is a private issue. It's more like a social security number. It's something that should not be permitted online. It should not be distributed without consent. So, you know, I'm fine with pornography if it's consent, but if it's not consent-based, then I do not think it should be allowed.
Yeah, and Tribs Over Trolls predates this issue, right? You've had this for a while.
Well, I've had this since this started. So it wasn't before my daughter. It was like in 2012 or 2013 when I started the Tribs Over Trolls.
And was it that brought Anonymous into the picture, or was it Anonymous that made you think, oh yeah, we need to use those resources?
I can't say that Anonymous, I'm sure, did it on their own. Yeah. And I can't say that prompted me to think of it either. I think I just thought of it, but Anonymous was great. And they, you know, I really think that them coming to the rescue might be one reason why Hunter didn't bring his site back, because he was threatening to make his site worse. He was threatening to put home addresses of victims along with driving directions on how to get to their houses. And it's possible that he would have done that had Anonymous not acted. So, yeah.
And if you could, we've touched on legislation. Are you working with or towards any legislation around this stuff?
Well, I'm not really doing anything actively, but I'm still hoping Congress is going to pass the law that Jackie Speier has proposed. Jackie Speier is a congresswoman who's been pushing something called the SHIELD Act. It's been proposed legislation on a federal level, has been proposed, I think, three times now, and the first two have failed. And this one doesn't look very good. But we do have, you know, the ACLU has been fighting us from the beginning, not only on federal legislation, but all the way back to when I started working with Senator Canella's office in California to make California the first state to have an anti-revenge porn law. And so they are one of the people who are fighting it. And the other is now on a federal level, there are some individuals on the progressive side of the Democratic Party who are of the defund the police mindset, who simply just don't want more laws that put people in jail. So they are also fighting against a federal revenge porn law. So right now we have state laws in 49 states. The only state that doesn't have it is South Carolina, but they're very weak. There tend to be misdemeanors. Even the Arizona law was just shot down by a court saying you can't even use this law anymore because they didn't feel it was constitutional. And it, you know, it doesn't translate from state to state. So if you have a victim in one state and a perp in another state, it's not even clear which law would pertain. So it's very confusing. It's not consistent. And we need something that's stronger where it can at least be a felony if the court decides it should be a felony. And so we need a federal law on this issue.
Yeah, and it seems like somehow you've got to take it away from being a First Amendment issue. Because like you said, you know, the First Amendment doesn't apply to screaming fire in a theater and stuff. So there are there's times when it doesn't apply. Mm-hmm. And so just like finally getting him based on hacking, you know, maybe there's something that's hacking related. I don't know. I'm trying to invent something I'm sure a lot smarter minds have thought about. But yeah, it seems like you're right. There should be something there in a national law, which not a fan of national laws for national laws' sake, but I think one like this would make sense. Mm-hmm. If you could talk about the animal advocacy, I am a big I don't want to say a big dog fan, but I am, and you know, one of my guests on this series is going to be somebody who does animal rescues and things like that. And when I saw you did this stuff as well, what is your involvement with that?
Well, I'm working on a book right now. So I do a lot of writing related to it. And so I'm working on a book right now called Omniocracy. And it's a term I invented, which means a government with representation for all living beings. I think democracy is of, by, and for the elite, the people, and animals are basically have, you know, they're just nothing according to our political system. They don't have standing in court. They're basically not protected. And so I would like to see a government that actually does provide protection for other living beings and takes their interests into calculation, into their decision making. And I would like to see animals have standing in court as well. So courts regularly only give humans that standing. So that's what I'm working on. I do a lot of academic stuff related to animal issues. Mm-hmm. I also just wrote a screenplay, like the first, as far as I know, the first anti-animal cruelty mainstream screenplay. Mm-hmm. So I just finished working on that. And I'm just about to start sending that out and working on that, getting it, you know, hopefully made into something. And but, you know, there are a lot of issues in the, you know, that you may read about, like, for example, the dogs that they use in vivisection, and they typically do research on beagle puppies. Why? Because beagles are very sweet, loving animals. They're particularly loving. You can torture them and they will still lick your hand. And that's why they are used. And there were 4,000 of them recently rescued from really disgusting conditions. And they're being put up for adoption around the country. But, you know, the NIH, the CDC, you know, Fauci, all of them, they do experimentation on animals all over the world, actually, because animals are basically considered garbage. They're trash. They're considered nothing to humans, to our system, you know, right. And because our system is all about money. It's all about people. It's all about, you know, lifestyle. Oh, well, that's my lifestyle. I don't want to change my lifestyle. So I don't want to know what goes on behind closed doors because I don't want to feel guilty about it. So, but let me continue to have my fancy lifestyle and accumulate as much money as possible. So, you know, non-humans are the victims of that. And I just like to do what I can to try to change that mindset. You know, when we left Afghanistan, our government left the dogs behind. You know, all the military contractor dogs were dumped at the airport and left behind. Many of them got killed. You know, England, you know, they got, UK got their dogs out. India got their dogs out, but not the United States. We left them behind. And we had a huge campaign at that time to try to get the US government to remove those dogs during the time that they were getting all the people out. There's no reason why they couldn't have, but the CDC was like, oh, well, we don't want them. They could be diseased. We don't want them in this country. And, you know, it was red tape, and the government really only looks to helping people. You know, they don't look at other life forms in general. So that's, you know, that's kind of what I feel is a very important mission for me. It's, you know, prejudice. Speciesism is a prejudice, just like racism, sexism, and anti-Semitism. And, you know, it's a form of prejudice. And I just like to see people open their hearts to other living beings.
Amen. Amen. Charlotte Laws, I want to thank you on so many fronts here for the activist work you do. And people hear that word activist. Right-wing people hear the word activist and they think, oh, you're just one of those, right? But activism simply means taking action, and that's it. And yeah, and taking action in some really great areas. So thank you for that.
Yeah, it's funny because I always hated the word activist, and people kind of all my life would call me an activist. And I'd say, no, I'm not an activist. I'm an advocate. And I saw an activist as someone who hadn't taken a bath for 2 months, who has ripped clothes. They're running through the street with a sign screaming at the top of their lungs. And so, no. But finally, after all these years, I've decided to embrace my inner activist. And you're right. It's being actively working for a cause. And I think it's a positive thing. So, but it is funny because I had such a resistance to that word for a really long time.
Right on. Charlotte, again, I want to thank you so much for sitting down with me and sharing some of your story as well. If you could quickly tell people how they can learn more about you, where they can find you online, things like that.
My Twitter is at Charlotte Laws, just like my name. My Instagram is Dr. Charlotte Laws. It's just Dr. Charlotte Laws. And those are probably the two main places. And if you want to know more about my life, I have two memoirs. One is called Undercover Debutante, and the other is called Rebel in High Heels. And so they both tell about different times in my life. And the revenge porn story is told in greater detail in the Rebel in High Heels book, if you want to know things more than what the documentary tells you.
Right on, right on. Again, thank you so much for sitting down with me.
Thank you for having me.